It's Easter.
Woo! Yeah!
What would you think if I told you I planned that out with that person who just came in? Would you believe it? I did. Lindsay, thank you. I owe you coffee. As I said earlier, I'm so glad that everyone who is here has chosen to be here this morning. I am. I really am. And I want you to know that sincerely. My life has become, in these last years, an effort really to do one thing, and that is to make as plain as I can the story that the Scriptures tell about God and about Jesus. And if this seems like an esoteric or an odd thing to you, I would say it's because it hasn't yet become plain, because I'm sure that the stories that are in here, they show us what we need to see, and they tell us what we need to hear. And I believe that in earnest, and that's why I'm here this morning and each week at Orban. So if you're a new face, I'm so glad you're here. If you've been here each week, let me tell you what we're going to do this morning for Easter. We've gone through this series from Gethsemane. That was the place where Jesus prayed after he had the Last Supper with his disciples. And last week we came all the way to the cross where he died. And that would have happened on a Friday. He died at around 3, and then he would have been buried by around 6. And that's where we left it last Sunday. And here's how the story goes for Easter morning. You ready for this? Jesus, who suffered all of that we've talked about, the one who went through all of that anguish and pain and then, in fact, saw death, over the weekend, he fought death and he won. Sunday morning came, and he had had a battle with death, and the victor was Jesus. That even though death had grabbed him and robbed him of his life, and he suffered all that anguish, on the third day, as we just sang, he arose. The grave and death was not strong enough to hold him. Instead, the power of God came, filled him up, and shattered the power of death, which is the one force that still, in our lives, frightens us and keeps the world in its grips. The story of Easter is that on that first morning, on Easter morning, Jesus conquered death and he arose. And now, so the story goes, that same power that brought Jesus back from the dead can be at work in each one of us to give us the power to live in this world in a different way. Is there anyone in here who believes that? Now let me ask you something. Is there anyone in here for whom that's hard to believe? Now I don't mean, listen now, I don't mean just the skeptic who came in this morning and has never really believed this church thing, but came because someone wants them to come on Easter. I'm glad you're here if that's you. But yes, maybe you don't believe it. But let me ask you disciples, those of you who are sincere about following Jesus, has there ever been a time in your life where this is hard to believe? Has that happened this week for some of you? Look at these four names here. Mark, Luke, Matthew, and John. These are the four Gospels. They're the books, the small books in the New Testament that tell the story of Jesus. In all four of them, Jesus dies on a cross on a Friday. And we've talked about these stories for weeks now and months. In all four of them, after he's dead, we hear nothing about what happens on Saturday because that's the Sabbath and no one's able to do anything. And in all four of them, do you know who we meet on Sunday morning first of all? Does anybody know? Shout out if you know. On Sunday morning, we meet some faithful women. By the way, I love this, and I'll get into this another time, but it's not the men who show up first, it's the women. That's right, the two Marys come. And they go early in the morning, but as the sun is rising, they want to go see the body of the one they love so much. And when they get there, in all four stories, the stone is gone, and they go and the body's not there. Now they're afraid. And they're sad, and they're confused. And then Jesus comes and meets them, and now they're convinced and filled with joy. And they run and go and tell the disciples. And do you know how their story is received by all of the disciples? Doubt. Every one of them. Now, again, I want to be clear. This is not the experience that they get when they go out into the world and try to tell people who never believed in Jesus in the first place. But the ones who were his closest friends, when they hear this story from these women, they do not believe it. They are filled with doubt instead. Now, I want to just show you this. In Mark, in that story at the end of Mark, we hear that after Jesus was crucified, the women go, they flee from the tomb, they go and find the disciples, and this is what it says. When they heard, the disciples, when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, that is the Mary, They would not believe it. After this story in Mark, those disciples who first heard from the Marys that Jesus was raised, they decide to go out for a walk. Two of them go out for a walk in the country. As they're walking, Jesus meets them. They run back to tell the other disciples, and this is what happens. It says they went back and told the rest, but they did not believe them. Now, you might think, well, isn't it different in the other Gospels? If we come to Luke, we hear a similar story. In Luke, there's a little more detail. The women come back to the men to say to them, Jesus has risen. And in Luke, this is what how he puts it. The words seemed to them an idle tale, and they did not believe them. That means that when the disciples heard the news of the resurrection, they thought it was a made-up story. That's what they thought. Again, in Luke, two of them go and take a walk. Maybe you know the story of the walk to Emmaus. A lot of us know that, don't we? On that road, the story goes, these two are walking along, and as they're going on this road, Jesus himself, the resurrected Jesus, meets them and starts walking and talking with them, and they don't even know it's him. That's how strong doubt was for them. He was walking with them, and they didn't even know it. Then he begins to talk to them from the scriptures. He shows them the Old Testament and says, look, it was talking about me. They still don't believe, and this is what he says. How foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe. They go back. They end up in a room with a bunch of the other disciples, and they start telling them the story of what happened, how they saw Jesus. Their hearts are full of doubt. Finally, Jesus shows up to all of them, and look what it says happens when they see him. In their joy, that means they see Jesus there with them at the table, and they're overjoyed, and look what it says. In their joy, they were disbelieving. Do you see some tension here between joy and disbelief? Maybe you are a follower of Christ and you've always been made to believe that faith is the opposite of doubt, and when you really believe, you never question again. Has anyone heard that kind of idea about what faith is? No, some of the kids have not. I think that it's a fairly common way to think about faith. Look what happens in Matthew. In Matthew, after the disciples are told by the women that Jesus has risen, they are told to go to a mountain, and then on the mountain he appears to them. The 11 apostles, these are the guys who started it all. They were Jesus' closest group. They themselves were there on the mountain. Jesus appeared with them. He was right there with them. And look what Matthew says happened when they saw him. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. That means Jesus was right there in front of them. And not just any old skeptics, but the 12 or 11 remaining apostles. He was right there with them. They were worshiping, and at the same time, they were also doubting. This tells us something about the experience of doubt. Now look at this. When we get to John, we meet the most famous doubter. Now I want you to look at this word. If I change doubt to doubting and then put a blank after it, what comes in the blank? Great. You all know that. Now, that, I would say that's one of, this right here represents one of the most popular stories from the Bible that has seeped into culture. And the reason I say this is it doesn't matter whether you have any belief at all in God or know much of the Bible at all. If you're a person who's known for not believing things, what do they call you? Doubting Thomas. We're going to look together at a story that takes place just the day after Easter, in which we meet this Doubting Thomas. And I want to say something else before we go into this. This morning is in part for every person in here who has faced and struggled with doubt. It's partly for all of you who are in that place. Now, some of you might not be disciples at all and think, well, is he going to prove to me that Jesus is real? I don't mean to do that. Thomas was not what he's known for, just a doubter. I'll say something about that in a minute. But for all of you who are Christians and who will one day face a time where you'll doubt, this is for you. This is also for the rest of us maybe who aren't feeling doubt. Are there any in here, Easter Sunday and I'm going to hear about doubt? What's wrong with this guy? Maybe some of you are very confident. It's also for us as a community. Because there is a lesson from Thomas, not only for doubters, but also for the church that would be open to doubters. And so I want to look at the story of Thomas together. This is what I want you to do. If you have a Bible, I want you to find the 20th chapter in John. And if you grabbed one from the Bible cart as you came in, this will be on page 883. If you have your own, again, it's John chapter 20, and we're going to look at verse 24. Before we look at the story of Thomas, I want to just give you a brief picture of what happened immediately before we meet Thomas, because this is important. Okay? So look up for just a minute. If I stand over here, can you still hear me in the back? If you couldn't hear me in the back and I asked that question, you wouldn't know I asked it, so you wouldn't have said anything. So, in John, on Easter morning, the women see the risen Jesus and they go tell the disciples, and they're not sure what to believe, so they all get together in a room. And it's Sunday evening, they're all there together wondering what to believe about Jesus, and then Jesus arrives. He shows up in the room, and he shows them his hand that had been pierced by the nails, and he shows them his side, which had a cut in it. And they rejoiced, and they believed. Now, that's where we meet Thomas. I want you to look at verse 24 of chapter 20. Starts with these words. But Thomas, who was called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands, and put my finger in the mark of the nails, and my hand in his side, I will not believe." Now listen, let's stop there for a moment. That night, when Jesus appeared to all of those who were gathered together, the disciples, and showed them that he was real, Thomas was not with them. Why not? Well, the story would go, according to some, he was so shallow in his faith and such a skeptic that when he finally saw Jesus died, he gave up and he went away. He was a realistic person, and he was not prone to fantasy, and so when he saw Jesus die, he took off. He wasn't a real disciple anyway. His belief was never real. That's why he left there. Do you know that is a common understanding of Thomas? That's why we call him Thomas the Doubter. Do you know that's absolutely not true of who he was? What would you think if I told you that Thomas was one of the few disciples who was willing to die for Jesus in his own earthly ministry? Many of you know the story of Peter, don't you? Peter said, "I would die before dying." Did you know that earlier in the Gospel of John, there's a story in which Jesus wants to go see his friend who has died? Maybe you know the story of Lazarus. Maybe you recall that when Jesus decided it was time to go see his friend Lazarus, all of the other disciples who were there with him, all of the apostles, said to him, "No, we can't go back to Bethany, because if we go there, Jesus, the Jews who are trying to kill you will get you, and you're likely to die. Let's not go over the other side of the Jordan. Let's stay on this side." Do some of you know that story? I preached that sermon once about how Jesus wanted to go, even if it meant dying, and none of the disciples wanted to go because they were afraid of dying. I left this part of the story out. There's one disciple among all of them who stands up and says, "You know what? We're going even if we die. Because that's what Jesus wants from us." Do you know who said that? Thomas. Does that sound like a doubter to you? Does that sound like someone whose faith is weak or shallow? No, that sounds like a brave disciple. That sounds like someone who's braver than I feel. Now let me ask you this. Some of you in here who struggle with doubt, has there ever been a time in your life where you felt as brave as that guy did? Has there ever been a moment like that? I have. I've had those moments, haven't you? You know, this teaches us that it's possible to be a doubter and also a very brave, courageous disciple. That's who this Thomas was. And that night when Jesus came back and made himself known to all the disciples, Thomas was not with them. It's not because he was a coward, or it's not because he didn't really have faith. Do you know why he wasn't there with them? Because he wanted to grieve by himself. Just think of it. Thomas, who was willing to die for Jesus, on Friday saw the man he would die for dying for him. On that afternoon of Good Friday, Thomas watched as Jesus, his very good friend, had nails driven into his hands. He watched as Jesus' side was pierced. He stayed there and observed as this man, in whom he had put all of his hopes, the one whom he had given up everything to follow for 3 years, the one, Jesus, who called Thomas one of his very closest followers and apostle, Thomas watched as this man actually died. He saw that happen. And do you know what it did to him? It shattered his heart. It made him feel altogether miserable. And so when Saturday was done and Sunday came around and all of the other apostles wanted to be together in their grief, Thomas wanted to go off by himself and to be alone because he was just that sad. Have you ever felt like that? I heard a child say no. Someday, I hate to say this, someday you will. And that's sad, but it's true. Isn't it true? Those of us who are adults in here, doesn't life sometimes get to that place where you think it's so bad you want to give up on everything? And not just give up on everything, but even those of us who are Christians may get to a place where Thomas was that night, where we're off on our own and we're pretty sure that God has failed. That we look at life as it has come to us, as we followed this Jesus, and all of our hopes didn't seem to come true. And we might be in a place where there's a lot more doubt than there is faith. Have you ever been there? I have been there. I'll tell you a story. About a dozen years ago, I was in a place in my life where it felt like nothing was good. And I mean that. It felt like everything was bad. And I was a Christian at the time, and I was trying to follow God. And it was very hard for me to have hope because my life had become so difficult. And it was early spring, and so do you know what I decided to do? I decided to make a garden. And do we have any gardeners in here? Are there gardeners? Raise your hand if you garden. Isn't there something uniquely hopeful when you put a little tiny seed in the dirt and then it turns into something that you can eat? Isn't that amazing? I thought this spring that I'll plant a garden and that will make my life feel okay. And do you know, I went and I found a plot of ground right near this wooded area, and I worked for days at cutting all the trees down. And at this point in my life, I didn't own an axe. I had an old machete. I'm serious. And I chopped and hacked and I tore up all these trees and I made a little plot of ground by the... Then I started to dig. I didn't have a rototiller or anything. I had a small plastic shovel from the beach. And I dug... I didn't know, that's a lie. I always say that. But I dug and I worked. And I worked for a week straight every day for 6 or 7 hours. And what I did while I dug is I thought, if I can just plant the garden and eat the food, I'll have hope. All the while, there was this little kid who lived in the neighborhood there. It's like 4 years old. He used to sit and watch me across the street while I did this, and I felt like so proud as I dug and sweat. I thought I was showing off for a 4-year-old. I got the seeds and I planted them. And this is about the time that I heard of that thing that really troubles gardeners. That I didn't know this before then, but that there are animals that live in the wild that eat your garden. Do people know about this? Everyone know about this? I didn't know about this, so I started to like read up on it, and I found out that you could like, if there was like the scent of people around, they would be less likely to come. So I shaved my head, and I sprinkled the hair all around the edge of the garden. I'm serious. Then I heard that there was this, you could buy this stuff that deer do in the wild. You know what I'm talking about? I'm not deer, sorry, foxes. You follow me? Is this all a little off color? They're wee-wee. That's for the kids. I couldn't afford that. I couldn't afford that, so I took care of that on my own, if you know what I mean. It was a part of my daily routine at the garden. My hands were regularly... I was working so hard, they were regularly... I would get blisters, and there would be blood, and I sprinkled that all around in hopes of keeping the deer away. And I worked... And let me tell you this lesson. The garden was so far away from my apartment that there was the only way to get water there was to fill buckets and carry them hundreds of yards. And I did it 3 times a day. And all the while, this little kid was watching me. You know, this is what happened. I had the most fantastic cherry tomato plants you could imagine. And every day I had to resist the temptation of picking those and eating them. I wanted to wait until they were just ripe enough. I even had tomatillos, you know, those little green tomatoes. There was cucumbers. There was just all kinds of herbs and so on. It was a fantastic and beautiful thing. And hope in my heart was being reborn this summer as it went along. You know where this is going, don't you? I came back one morning before I harvested a single morsel, and everything had been eaten all the way down to the dirt. I'm telling you, it shattered me. I looked at the garden, I stood there for a long while, and I walked away from it. And I went and I sat down on the curb. And the truth is, that was not the hardest thing in my life then, the garden. But it was so symbolic for me. And I sat down, and I wanted to give up. And I thought to myself, how could God be good? Have you felt like that ever? Columbia. This is what I did. Listen, as I was sitting there, you ever get that feeling that someone's staring at you? I looked up and it was that 4-year-old who was watching me the whole time. He's just looking at me like this. And he said, what's warm? So I told him, not only about the garden, but I got a little overboard. I started telling him about how hard my life was. And he was sort of looking at me like, what's wrong with you? But he just was quiet the whole time, and I went on, and I told him about this trouble and that trouble and the garden and those blasted deer and what I would do to them if I caught them. And I went on and on like this, and he listened the whole time, and I finally stopped realizing I was talking too much, and I looked up at him, and you know what he said to me? He said, why didn't you just go to the grocery store and buy the vegetables? I won't tell you. Listen. Thomas was a real follower of Jesus. He wasn't just a skeptic who always disbelieved. He really believed in him. And his experience got him to the place where he was ready to give up because his doubt was stronger than his faith. And I'll tell you this. I'm honestly convinced that experience of Thomas's is far more common than we'd like to admit. I think when we feel it, we have an impulse that makes it so that we think we're the only Christian who's ever felt like this. We look around at other people and their faith and we imagine that it's so much stronger than ours. And so we go on in our isolation feeling this terrifying doubt. But I'm sure it's more common than we let on. And the question that matters for us and for you and for me and for this entire church this morning is simple. It's this. It's not, will we ever doubt, or will there ever be a person who comes into this church who doubts? The question is, what does the disciple do with her doubt? And what does the community do with the doubter? Do you understand those questions? It means, if you, or if I, or if any one of us starts to feel doubt, what should we do with it? And I'll tell you, there are terribly common options that people pursue. I think the first option that's the most common when any one disciple feels doubt in a place like this is to pretend. Is to fake it, is to make believe that you don't have any questions or any struggles and that you're just totally confident in your faith. Now, this is where Thomas is so beautiful for us. Did you see what he did when he felt this doubt? Look at the last four words there. I will not believe. Thomas does not pretend. It would have been very easy for him to come back that night. Imagine if you would. All of the people that you've been going along with for your entire last 3 years of your life. It would be like this entire church is believing in Jesus. You come back and you don't. And they all say to him, oh, we saw him. He's alive. He is risen. And you don't believe. Can you feel the pressure of pretending? Thomas doesn't pretend. He tells them quite plainly, I doubt it. I don't believe it. And he does not pursue the option of making believe. And this should be an example for all of us here, any one of us who will someday feel doubt. This should be an example to us that we should never pretend. If we don't believe, if we are feeling doubt, it is okay to say that. Now, there's a second option for those of us who are willing to admit our doubt, like Thomas was, which is also common, which is also destructive. Do you know what that second option is? When you feel doubt, this is what the second option is. Give up. Who said that? Yeah, give up and leave the community. It would have been very easy for Thomas to come and say, I don't believe anymore, and then for him to give up and go away. If you have your Bible, look at what happens next. It's going to be up here as well. Look at this. Watch. After he says he will not believe, a week later, his disciples were again in the house and Thomas was with them. Do you see what that is? That means that Thomas went to the community and said, I can't believe it, and then he stayed there. Now, this is simple. It teaches us something about what the doubter can do with their doubt if they're not willing to fake it. And it also teaches us what the community can do with the doubter if it's going to be the true community of Jesus Christ. The first thing, the doubter who's not willing to fake it can come into the community and say, I'm not sure I believe, and then choose to stay there. There is a sort of half-hearted heroism that we attach to doubt, that it's really cool to sort of not believe. And then people come around and say, well, I'm a skeptic and I don't believe, and then they go away. Do you know what that sort of doubt is? That's just as fake faith is. He's not willing to do that. Thomas is sincere in his doubt, and what he does is he does not give up and go away, but he chooses to stay there, which I believe means that he is so serious about following Christ that even his doubt can't overcome him. And he brings that doubt right into the heart of the community and is honest about it because he's not willing to give up. He wants to fight through it. And so he stays there for a week. Think of the pressure. Think of how uncomfortable it might have been. But he chose to stay. This is what I want to say to every one of you here this morning who is a doubter in one way or another. You have an option, and it is to be honest and to stay. Now, this is the thing that I want to say to the community, because if this isn't true, you can't live that option out. What would have to be true of this community for him to stay, even after he doubts? I mean, this is a simple question. It's got a very simple answer. It would have to be a community that was willing to leave people who doubted among them and not push them away. It would have to be a community that trusted in God enough to believe that even when some of their number was doubting, that God would be strong enough to make it okay, and that therefore they did not need to push that person out. Now, this is a word to all of us here who are not in doubt right now. And I want us, each one of us, to hear this clearly. If we will be a true community of Jesus Christ when there is a person among us who doubts, and I know some of you personally that you struggle with doubt, that what we're called to do if we're going to be a community of true disciples is to leave room for those people in their doubt. Not to argue with them and convince them of the truth that they can't see yet. Not to fight with them or push them to a place that we want them to be, but they're not. But to trust that if they're willing to be honest about their doubt and stick around in the community, that there is someone who will address that problem. And do you know who that someone is? It's not us. See, in this story of Thomas, a week passes and he's there with those disciples, having expressed his doubt, having told them what it is that would make him believe. We don't read that they convince him or that they change his mind themselves, but look what happens. I'm going to read this for you. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Listen, that means that when Thomas was willing to be honest about his doubt and to stick around in the community, Jesus showed up. And this is the truth of what happened on that evening. That Thomas and the community were willing to be honest about where Thomas was, and Jesus had seen the struggling and the fighting for faith in Thomas, and Jesus arrived. Now, I'll tell you this, and I can't argue for this or prove it. I might not be able to convince you. It's not my job. But when a doubter is willing to fight through their doubt to faith, Jesus shows up. Let me ask this. Is there anyone who knows that from experience? Do you? If you do, you should share that with people. I know it from experience. I'll tell that story another time. I want you to look at this, and this is the last thing that we're going to do together. This is a painting of the scene that we just read as it was depicted by the Italian painter Caravaggio. We've looked at a lot of his paintings together in this series. Here's his depiction of what we just read. I want you to look closely at it. You see the way he's grouped the faces of the men? I've made it easier to see. Watch this. Do you see how they're all there in that diamond? Now, I'm sure that the man who painted this understood something that the gospel writer John wanted us all to understand. See, look, first of all, you can't see this because you might be too far away. The foreheads of the three men on the right, they're all wrinkled up because these were the men who were struggling with doubt. They were the disciples who were overjoyed but also disbelieving, who worshipped him but doubted. They were the ones who believed but also still had questions. He has their foreheads all wrinkled. If you could see clearly, Jesus' forehead is as smooth as ice. He comes among these doubters with his confidence. And what Caravaggio wants us to see, which is what John wants us to see, is two things. And I'll tell you why I know it's two things. You know how an artist directs our attention toward the focal points of a painting when there are characters in there often? He does this by where their eyes are looking. I want you to look in the bottom first. That there is Thomas. I put that arrow in there so that you could see where his eyes go. You have to trust me on the direction of it. It looks a little bit like he's got laser beam eyes, but I didn't mean for that to be true. That's where Thomas looks. Now, if we go up around, you see up on the left there is, that's Jesus. Look where his eyes are. Thomas looks this way, and look where Jesus' eyes go. They go down here. And now over to the right, one of the other disciples. At first, when I first saw this, I assumed that he was also looking at Jesus' side, but if you look closely, and it's hard to see here, you'll notice that he doesn't. He's actually looking behind Thomas and down. And at this point, it looks like we have three men looking in three different directions, doesn't it? But when you add that third man on the top, he looks straight down almost. Do you notice what we have here? We have Thomas looking one way, and that's one point in the painting. And then to the right of it, we have all three of these men looking at the exact same spot. And that's the second focal point of the painting. Because Caravaggio wants us to see two things that John wants us to see. And here's what he wants us to see. Thomas first. Thomas is looking at his hand going into the side of Jesus. Because Thomas has gotten to the place where he's able to see what he was willing to fight for. And this, I believe, Caravaggio wants us to see. Because John wants us to see that the promise to any person who is willing to persist in their doubt and fight for faith is that Jesus will come and they will see what they need to see. That's a promise. It's put by Jesus in another place. If any man would seek me, if any woman would knock, if anyone would search, they will find me. Don't try to pretend here. Thomas was not just pretending. He was in earnest. And the promise is that if anyone seeks, they will find. That's the first thing he wants us to see. Now, look at the second thing. And this, by far, to me, is more beautiful. You see where these all intersect? All three of those other men are not looking at Thomas's hand. They're looking at that other hand there. Can you tell where that hand comes from? That's the hand of Jesus. He wants us to see that the doubter does not grab a hold of Jesus, but Jesus grabs a hold of the doubter. That it's not on you, if you're struggling with doubt this morning, to find a way to grab a hold of him. It's only for you to believe that he is already looking for you to grab a hold of you. And he will if you'll search. And he will if you're honest about your doubt and don't hide it. And he will if you're willing to stick around in the community. And he will, listen, this is for all of us, if this church becomes a place where we trust Jesus enough to allow people who have doubts to remain. And I want to say this with all clarity on this Easter morning, that I'm sure that what the living Lord Jesus Christ wants from you and from me and from this church is to be a place where people can be honest about their doubts, not so they can stay in their doubts, but so that Jesus can grab a hold of them and draw them to himself. And that's what this church exists for. For people to come to know the living Lord Jesus Christ. Now, we're done with this series. And all that remains is this, and it's simple, but it's important. Will any one of you who've been here all along, would any one of you be willing to be a part of a community that brings those who are far away near to the living Lord Christ? Would you? If you would, that's what Outreach Red Bank is for. It's a community that exists to become a place where people who don't know Christ come to know him. If you've come to visit this morning and you're thinking, I've been far away from him, I don't know him, you would be welcome here all along. If you've come all the time, and if you're here every week, the challenge for you is to go out into this world as a participant in a community that exists to bring people to a place where they come to know Christ. Can this happen? The answer is quite simply, yes, because of the character who is on the left side of this painting. Because Jesus Christ is alive, we can and will be his witnesses in this world. Now we will only do this if we are open to the power of this Lord. And so I want to ask you to close your eyes now and pray with me. And while I'm praying, we'll have the musicians come up and they'll lead us as we continue to worship together. Let's go.